Hey, this is Ed. So this is a podcast, is that right?
This is.
Okay. We're officially podcasting right now. That's awesome.
This
is Straight from the Cutter's Mouth.
Welcome to Straight from the Cutter's Mouth, a retina podcast. At least once a week, we bring you insights and perspectives from the world of vitreoretinal surgery. I'm your host, Dr. Jay Schreather. Today on episode 114, I'm joined by Dr. Nathan Steinle of California Retinal Consultants to discuss pneumatic vitreolysis for vitreomacular traction. As a separate shameless plug, anyone who is attending the ASRS annual meeting in Vancouver this year, if you enjoy this program, please try and attend our first ever social media and online content course for ophthalmologists. This is an instructional course that will be on Friday, July 20th, starting at 1 p.m. The panelists include Dr. Sunir Garg, Charles Wyckoff, David Almeida, Ajay Kurian, and myself. If you need more details, feel free to contact me directly, and we look forward to seeing you there. Straight from the Cutter's Mouth is now happy to be joined by Dr. Nathan Steinle. Dr. Steinle is an associate at California Retina Consultants, based in Santa Barbara, California, and he's here today to talk about various topics, including pneumatic vitreolysis. Nathan, how are you, and good morning.
Hey, good morning. Thank you so much for having me.
So it's first time on the program, so we always start our interviews with new guests by targeting our younger audience, the residents and fellows who may be listening, looking for inspiration. So how did you first decide becoming an ophthalmologist and a retina specialist? Was this something that you had in mind when you went to medical school?
Yeah, really good question. Not at all. It wasn't really even on my radar. I knew very early on in kind of my preclinicals and also in medical school that I really liked surgery. And I could spend all day in the OR, and I thought it was just the most fantastic place in the world. I didn't always love the hospital situation. So I'd go out in the wards, and it would be kind of a slug for the day to kind of get through it. But I liked being in the OR. So I knew kind of early on I wanted to have some kind of specialty that allowed me to be in the OR, but also have kind of a clinic-based practice. And so when you kind of narrow down the options, I actually thought about ENT, and I also thought about OBGYN a lot. But I thought that ophthalmology kind of gave me the perfect balance of not only being in the OR, but also, you know, following patients long-term and having kind of long-term clinic relationships with patients.
And so you ended up matching in residency in Kentucky and doing your residency there. And then what drew you to retina? Was that something you thought about going when you went to op residency, or did you kind of find it as you went along?
Yeah, really, really good question. So amazing. I grew up in South Dakota. So there's not even very many people there, let alone ophthalmologists there. But randomly, there's a really high-powered Wills-trained retina specialist there, Prem Abraham, who was kind of my mentor growing up in my hometown. And so I had, you know, the person I looked up to the most was a super high clinic volume and also a research volume Wills-trained retina specialist in my backyard in South Dakota. And so she kind of introduced me early into retina. And then going to my residency, I had a lot of great mentors there to look up to kind of push me forward into retina. It seemed like the natural choice. And then I went on to the Cleveland Clinic for my two-year vitreoretinal fellowship there, and just have loved the field ever since.
So one of the things you've become well known for is you've spoken about various meetings is this concept of pneumatic vitreolysis. So let's start first how you first got exposed to this, and then let's talk a little bit what it is for people who may not be familiar.
Yeah, really good question. So, you know, like a lot of private practices, so I'm in a group of now 10 retina specialists in kind of central and southern California, and we're private practice, and we have 12 different offices now. And so what we find is when we go out into the hinterlands, kind of the far satellites, you see a lot of patients with this VMT, and I think it was kind of a perfect situation for me because, first off, in our area out here, a lot of the local referring physicians were just getting OCTs for the first time several years ago, and so you have this whole mass of patients that are now getting imaged that perhaps weren't getting imaged before, and we're finding all these VMTs and sometimes finding them earlier and referring them over our way. And then you're in a satellite clinic and getting these patients to drive long distance to a possible OR procedure was very difficult. And it was also the time that the enzymatic release of VMT, ochroplasm, was coming on the market as well. And so we had some experience with that, and we knew some of the pluses and minuses with that product. And so we started looking at other options for these patients, and we'd heard about some case series from Europe, and some case series in the United States about using gas in the eye, in a non-vitrectomized eye, just in a clinic setting, to release that vitreo macular traction. And so if you look back, there's actually some really good papers from Clement Chan back from the 1990s looking at release of VMT and looking at closure of macular holes, especially small macular holes in non-vitrectomized eyes with just a simple gas bubble injection. And so there's also lots of reports out of Europe, too, looking at C3FA gas injections in the non-vitrectomized eyes for release of VMT. And so we started a case series here in California, and we were highly impressed by how well it worked. And as far as the technique goes itself, it's a very straightforward technique. And it takes about as much time as your typical intravitreal injection. And then for me personally, I prep and drape the patient just like I do for a typical intravitreal injection. And I use a speculum, and I use a subconjunctival lidocaine, and then I also use a betadine prep. And I personally like to do a paracentesis, and I do a paracentesis at the limbus with just a 30-gauge needle with an open syringe with no plunger in it. And I do a tap of the AC before my injection of gas. And then once I do my tap of the AC and I try and reduce the pressure down to, you know, 4, 5, or 6 millimeters of mercury, I then inject the gas bubble. And I've been doing my technique now where I inject straight superiorly. So I have the patient sitting upright and looking down to the ground, and I inject that gas bubble straight superiorly. And then I'm sure, Jane, one of the next questions would be, what gas do I use and what volume do I use? Should I go ahead and talk about that now?
Yeah. So, and before we get into that, two questions the listeners may ask or think about. One is, how you said you tap to a certain pressure, but how much volume do you typically try to tap? And the second is, I'm assuming you're injecting superiorly to minimize fish eggs?
Exactly right. So really, two good questions. So first off, as far as the AC tap goes, my technique is I always have a cotton swab in my opposite hand. And so when I have the 30-gauge needle with a TB syringe with the open plunger or, you know, missing plunger into the limbus, I'm using my offhand with a cotton swab to kind of milk the last bit I can out. And I don't have a specific volume I'm looking for. I'm just looking to get as much out of the AC, flatten AC as much as I possibly can. You know, typically it's probably on the order of about 0.1 or 0.15 cc's of aqueous I'm able to evacuate. It's a little more tricky in phakic patients because I want to make sure I don't collapse the anterior chamber and, you know, cause any defects in the anterior capsule with my needle. But in pseudophakic patients, you can be fairly aggressive with needle placement and really getting a nice volume of aqueous out. And then the second question about the fish eggs, we went round and round about this. And so fish eggs, of course, are when you inject gas into an eye, you can have, you know, one large cavity of a gas bubble, or you can have multiple little small bubbles. We call those fish eggs. And the you could make the argument almost this is the one time with vitreomacular traction that maybe it's almost good to have fish eggs. Mm-hmm. But just being a purist from all of our days of doing pneumatics for retinal detachment, I think we've all just kind of had the mindset that one gas ball is what we typically want to shoot for. And so I've kind of migrated from just a positional standpoint to just it's more comfortable for the patient to be sitting upright. And then it's just very simple and controlled if you have them look down and I inject at the pars plana straight perpendicular when they're looking down into the vitreous cavity. And that does minimize fish eggs. And as far as my volume, I kind of tried a whole bunch of different volumes. And just to kind of give the listeners a sense of scale, I'm probably approaching about 100 patients now overall I've injected with gas and air. So it's a nice volume of patients. And I would say that my go-to technique now is to use about 0.3 cc's of whatever gas you want to choose, and we'll talk about that in a second. But my volume I typically use is 0.3, and when I've given this talk to at societies and at different research meetings, people have said, oh, you can use a lot higher volume, you can use 0.5 or even more, especially if you want to do repeat taps. Mm-hmm. And that's probably true, but I've never found that makes that much of a difference. I'm always a little bit more nervous about that high pressure immediately after the gas injection. Mm-hmm. Than the actual volume of the gas.
Let's talk about the gas you pick, and that may tie into what you were talking about. Does the volume actually affect the success rate? Because the goal, like you said, is to induce the PVD. So based on the research you guys have done, what gas do you like to use and why based on the data?
Yeah, really good question. So when we first looked at all the literature reports, everyone almost across the board was using C3F8. And of course, C3F8 has some great properties in that it expands about four times the volume you put it in if it's 100%. It also lasts, you know, up to 2 months. And we found in these non-vitrectomized eyes, it can even last up to 12 weeks in some of them. So it has some nice properties that it stays around for a long time, and it also has a nice expansion to it. And so that was our go-to at first, and we published our first case series with C3F8. And pretty impressively, we had an 80-plus percent release rate, about mid-80s, 80, 82, 83, 84% release rate with just C3F8. And the other interesting thing with that is that we were taking all comers. We were taking patients that had diabetes mellitus, and there's some theory that those are more difficult patients because they may have more sticky hyaloid or more kind of adherent vitreoretinal interface. And so you wanted to really test against those patients to see if it would actually work in those patients, and it did. We also looked at patients with epiretinal membrane, and in the MIBI Trust acroplasm data, that was a negative prognostic factor for whether or not acroplasm would work would be the presence of an epiretinal membrane. And we haven't really found that same to be true for C3F8. It seems to work well whether or not they have an epiretinal membrane or not. And then finally, we also used it in patients that had failed past acroplasm, and it worked well in those patients too. So it seemed to kind of work well for all comers. So for C3F8, it seemed to be a really good option for patients. The downsides are basically two, is that it does last a long time, especially in a non-vitrectomized eye. So if I take your IJ or my eye and I inject 0.3 cc's of 100% C3F8, non-vitrectomized eye, it'll be there for 2.5, maybe up to 3 months sometimes. Mm-hmm. And so for patients that are flying or patients that have altitudinal restrictions or just simply positioning, you know, going up and down stairs or trying to read, it becomes kind of onerous or difficult to have that tamponade or that scotoma in a patient for that length of time. And so in California, we have a lot of high mountains here that we had to have patients kind of change their travel plans or change their lifestyle over that time period. And then also there's a case series or two in the literature about using SF6. So then we said, well, maybe SF6 would be a sweet spot where you're getting a nice gas bubble in the eye, and it'll last for a while, but it won't last near as long, and it won't get quite as large. And so maybe you can have a good success rate with SF6. And so we started a case series looking at SF6 injections, where same volume, same technique, same kind of patient population. And so we inject 0.3 cc's of 100% SF6. And it would work, but it wouldn't work to the same degree. We were getting kind of release rates on the order of about 55 to 60% of the time, as opposed to 80-plus percent of the time with C3F8. And so the take-home message is that kind of a bigger gas bubble seems to be better in our patients. And I think part of the reason for that is twofold, one of which is that the SF6 doesn't last as long. And I think there's a longevity effect. And what we've been doing with these patients is we, you know, image them on before we inject them with OCT. We also image them, you know, when they come back to clinic every time. And so we can kind of follow when they release. And it's pretty impressive. A decent percentage of patients, maybe even up to a third, fourth to one-third of patients, will release their VMT overnight. So they've had VMT for months and months and been symptomatic for a while. And you inject a gas bottle, whether it's SF6 or C3F8, and, you know, a fourth to a third of them will come in the next day and have released VMT. And, of course, for those patients, whether you use SF6 or C3F8, I don't think it makes any difference at all. In fact, you probably want to use SF6 because the gas bottle goes away quicker. But the tricky part is some patients don't release until a month down the road, maybe even 6 or 7 weeks down the road. And I think it's those late releasers that the C3F8 then kind of has that statistical significant difference or better outcomes with versus SF6 is because you're keeping that bubble in there longer, it's working longer, the patient's living their life, and it's kind of rolling across that macula more often and for longer periods of time. And so eventually it releases it allows those late releasers to actually have the outcome that you want, that release of the VMT versus SF6. And then the final question is that, you know, well, what if you use something really short? Well, if some patients release with just overnight, why not just use air? And so I've done a case series, too, of just using atmospheric air filtered atmospheric air. And so in those patients, you know, same technique, same prep, same injection, I use 0.3 cc's of just 100% air. It's amazing how quickly a gas bubble goes away, and in just a couple of days, the gas bubble's gone. And so for those patients, I've been really militant about having them do something called the drinking bird technique. And what that is we want patients, you know, every hour, every half an hour, to kind of bob their head and have their nose go down to a straight down positioning, so they're looking straight down at the ground. And what that does is it allows whatever gas bubbles in the vitreous cavity to roll across their macula and hopefully potentiate the release of the VMT. And so if you're going to use air, you only have a couple days to have that bubble work to your advantage. And so I've had patients do the drinking bird every 15 minutes while awake to see if they can release that VMT. And we've unfortunately not had great success with the air. It's been much, much lower. I mean, less than 30% or so overall, maybe even less than that with air. And I think it's just a matter of, it works in some patients that overnight, and it might be even more just the injection technique rather than the gas bubble itself in those patients. But it doesn't have that longevity as SF6 and especially as CCF8 to have those late releasers release the VMT over time.
So we're all really, really good pearls. I think that, so if you have a patient with vitreomacular traction, and what do you tell them in kind of an order, given everything you know from your guys' experience, which is extensive and really kind of the backbone, along with a couple other people of the literature available on this subject, the success rate,
yep,
the complications, and then what do you, is it something that you'll repeat? So you talked about air SF6, maybe there's these late releasers, for example, with C3F8 that may release with C3F8, but not with SF6. Do you ever repeat this in a patient, or do you go straight to vitrectomy? And does their phakic status play any role? Because some people will argue, well, if they're pseudophakic, you know, doing a vitrectomy because there's no cataract risk, even though it's still surgery, I'd still rather do that than inject a bubble. So how do you take the patient through it, and how do you make your final decision on what to recommend? And then if it doesn't work, what you recommend next?
Yeah, really, really great question. So, you know, if I have my typical VMT patient, of course, the first standard of care is just observation. There's a nice case series out just recently in ophthalmology talking about, you know, there's a small percentage of patients that will release even if you follow them long term. And so I typically give them, you know, at least 2 to 3 months to see if they'll release their VMT on their own. And most of the time, you're disappointed they don't. But sometimes you get surprised. So those patients, most patients are weeded out, the patients that will release without any intervention. And then next, my decision tree kind of comes to, you know, either pharmacologic vitreolysis with aquaplasm or pneumatic vitreolysis with some sort of gas tamponade or surgery. And so you asked a really good question about the phakic status. And one of the things we looked at with all of our gas series is whether the phakic versus pseudophakic status made a difference. And it really didn't. That was another thing that in MIVI Trust for aquaplasm, it seemed that the phakic patients did better than the pseudophakic patients. But with gas, it didn't seem to make much of a difference. And so my typical patient, what I do is I typically do offer them pneumatic vitreolysis next. And so as far as the gas to choose, I actually based it a lot on their geographical preferences and their lifestyle. I actually done a lot of patients with kind of what I would call step therapy, where I inject one gas bubble, and if it doesn't work, then you can inject do that same gas bubble, or you can inject a different gas bubble that's a longer acting one. So my typical technique, if a patient has, you know, high work demands or high travel demands or they fly a lot, you can certainly do SF6 and just let them know it's a lower success rate. The gas bubble will go away much quicker. And then, you know, you hope for the best, but if it doesn't work, then you can move on to do either another SF6 bubble, or you can do CCF8 as kind of the more definitive gas bubble for these patients. So absolutely, to answer your question, I think step therapy works. And then you can make the argument that, well, maybe the first bubble kind of loosens the fibers for the second gas bubble, and that's why you can get the second gas bubble to work. And, you know, I've had the patients that have tried aquaplasm on first, and then moved on to a gas bubble, and it worked for those patients as well. And again, you can maybe make the argument that the aquaplasm loosens those vitreoretinal interface fibers, and then it's just, you know, the quote unquote loosening the pickle jar, you know, the pickle jar, so that the second gas bubble then will eventually just knock off the VMT and make it easier. But yeah, I think step therapy is definitely a reasonable option. And then finally, talking about risks of gas bubbles, and then we'll talk about vitrectomy itself. You know, obviously, vitrectomy is a definitive surgery for these patients, and but it's not without risks. We obviously know that these patients have an atypical vitreoretinal interface, and so they're higher risk for iatrogenic tears and idiopathic tears and retinal detachments in these types of patients, because I think not only do they have the atypical central vitreoretinal interface, but I think they have the atypical vitreous base interface as well. So if you're going to do vitrectomy, it's a totally reasonable option, but just be careful and depress well and make sure you laser any suspicious areas. Next, I would say that the gas bubble technique, as far as complications we've seen, definitely seen a few, but they're few and far between. We've had one patient who had kind of a pupillary block who didn't understand the positioning and went home and slept supine, you know, looking straight up at the ceiling, and had kind of a pupillary block that we had to manage medically to get the pressure down the next day. And then we've had two patients develop peripheral retinal tears with a gas bubble injection. And the reason why, of course, is that you're inducing a PVD in these patients. And so you can get retinal tears and retinal detachments in these patients. And if you look at case series from Calvin Mean in Texas and Clement Chan here in California, they also kind of report a low incidence, but you can watch these patients for either peripheral tears or retinal detachment, just as you would with your surgery patients. When you're inducing that PVD, you kind of want to watch these patients. And I think that the one drawback, I'd say, for the pneumatic technique is obviously there's a lot of positives. It's super cheap. I mean, it's 10 cents for the procedure. It's repeatable. It's able to do it in the clinic setting. Those are all positives. You can do it in fake and pseudofake patients. You can do it in ERM patients. You can do it in diabetic patients. But one of the things it doesn't do is it doesn't remove floaters. And so I kind of tell patients ahead of time when I'm going to do the gas bubble injection that look forward to seeing floaters, because that's a positive prognostic sign that you're actually releasing those fibers. And so that I kind of get patients to be excited about the floaters. I know they're probably heading their way because the majority of the time the technique works. And so I want them to kind of know that that's part of the success, is that they might have some floaters long term from that release of the EMT. My decision tree then is, you know, I do pneumatic and it doesn't work, I'm happy to do another gas bubble. If that doesn't work, and I finally just mentioned that the small percentage of patients that I then have to move on to vitrectomy for, the vitrectomy has been no different than a typical VMT vitrectomy, that is a, you know, quote unquote virgin eye, so the eye doesn't behave any differently. I will say, in general, those patients have very, very, you know, thick, sticky hyaloids, kind of almost like a uveitic hyaloid. And I think that's what got them into the trouble to begin with. And they just have very difficult adhesions to remove surgically. And I think that's also why the gas bubble didn't work on that small percentage of patients. It was really difficult VMT patients, but they behave very similarly in surgery if you move on to that step and their outcomes are good.
So two final questions on the subject. The first is, given the tear risk, do you ever pre-treat patients with lattice or any suspicious pathology in the periphery before you do the gas bubble? And my second question, which I'm sure I'll get an email about, is if you do the procedure, what code do you use CPT-wise if you're coding for the procedure?
Yeah, awesome. So two really good questions. So I'm very conservative with the lasering ahead of time. So if I see any lattice or suspicious pigmentary areas or just an area of a tuft, I absolutely do laser ahead of time. And I think I do it about a month ahead of time and let the laser kind of, you know, take up shop that creates that choroidal scar. So I feel like there's a nice barrier around any suspicious areas. And I think it does two things. First off, it kind of, again, warns the patient that, hey, there's some suspicious areas ahead of time that we got to watch. And it kind of reaffirms that this technique is not without any risk. And then second, it gives me a lot more comfort to put the gas bubble in when I know that peripheral areas are treated. So yeah, the answer is absolutely, I treat any peripheral areas of concern, especially lattice. And then your other question about the billing, I would love to get some emails and I'd like to get some advice. The number one question I get when I've gone to these conferences and to these meetings is first off, what gas, and would you ever try, you know, a shorter acting gas bubble? But the second question is, how do you code for this? And I think it's highly debatable. It's not a known code that people are using. So I've heard all across the board, I'll kind of give you a spectrum. Some people treat it as kind of almost a pneumatic retinopexy code. There's other people that just code for just the paracentesis, and if you just code for the paracentesis, there's no global on that, so you can then have a patient outside the global afterwards. And then, you know, the gas bubble itself costs 10 cents. So I typically don't code for the injection or the coating of the gas bubble, but I would certainly appreciate some insights from the billing gurus on that as well.
Well, Dr. Steinle, thanks so much for joining us and talking to us about pneumatic retrolysis, which again is a hot topic, vitreomacular traction, more and more commonly recognized, as you said, with OCT and the technology we have available. And you're a very accessible person. I know you've always made yourself open to meetings. So anyone listening has questions, they can send them to me and I'll forward them along to Nathan. And I'm sure he'll always happy to answer questions about this.
Absolutely. One last kind of plug, too, is that it's gotten to be such a hot topic. The DRCRNet is now studying it. So there's protocols now that have been put in place that they're working on. So the DRCRNet is going to look at both gas pneumatic vitreolysis for patients with small macro holes with VMT, and they're also going to look at patients with just VMT alone. So there's two protocols that they're going forward with to look at this subject in kind of a randomized fashion now. So I'm excited to see the results and looking forward to DRCRNet to make this even more well known.
Perfect. Well, Nathan, thanks so much for waking up early on the West Coast to talk to us, and I'll talk to you again soon.
Yep. Thank you so much.
Have a great day.
Yeah, you too. Thank you for the opportunity.
As always, you can find this episode and all prior episodes on our website, retinapodcast.com. That's RETINAPodcast.com. All 114 episodes, including this one, can be found there sorted by category. You will also find our blog, Equal Ground and Reactive Lessons from Our Pupils. Also on the website, you can sign up for our mailing list to get updates on the most recent episodes. At the bottom are links to subscribe in the iTunes Store as well as Google Play. You can also like our Facebook page or find us in the podcast section of the iTunes Store and Google Play. We are on Twitter at Retina Podcast, and to contact us, click on the contact us link on our website or email us at retinapodcast@gmail.com. We appreciate anyone subscribed to iTunes or Google Play to leave your positive comments in the form of a review. Many thanks to Dr. Nathan Steinle for joining me. Thanks to Louis Kai, Mike Benacosta, and Angela Chang for producing a great episode. Listeners, thank you for what you do on a daily basis, the patient care you provide, the articles you read and publish, the conversation you inspire here. This is Jay Schrather signing off.
Feeling.
This is straight from the cutter's mouth.